The History of Literature podcast is a member of the Podglomerate Network and LitHub Radio.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Hello, Ralph Waldo Emerson was born in 1803 in a nation of 5 million people, about a quarter of whom were enslaved. It was a new government then, on its third president. 3 weeks before Emerson was born, the country had made a purchase, 530 million acres of territory, doubling the country's size for 3 cents an acre. There were no cars or electricity, of course, and for the first 27 years of Emerson's life, there was no railroad. It was a place that took its cultural lead from Europe, which had 150 million people and population centers like Paris, which had 500,000, or London, which had over 1 million. New York City had just 60,000 people, which was more than double the size of Boston. Slavery existed and women could not vote. No internet, no television, no radio, no smartphones. Emerson once gave a speech entitled The American Scholar, which Oliver Wendell Holmes Sr. called America's Intellectual Declaration of Independence. But it's fair to ask the questions, what can Ralph Waldo Emerson possibly have to say to us today? Why should we even bother? How could a man born to a world so different from ours speak with relevance, let alone insight? James Marcus has been reading Emerson and exploring these very issues. He helps us understand who Emerson was, what he wrote about, and why we should care. Today, on the History of Literature. Okay, here we go. Welcome to the podcast. I'm Jack Wilson, looking to transcend. That's one key to Emerson, I think, right there in the name, transcendentalism. I mentioned that Europe had 150 million people. Well, Asia had over 600 million in 1800. America was growing fast. It had the frontier as a metaphor and as an actual thing. It had its own history, its own religion, its own relationships with its neighbors, a revolutionary war under its belt, a newfangled written constitution, an ugly history with the displacement of native peoples. A lot of complexity that we don't want to overlook. But in the narrow prism of mostly white, mostly male, mostly New Englanders looking back across the Atlantic Ocean for artistic or cultural or literary guidance, it also had spirits like Emerson and Thoreau and Melville and Hawthorne who wanted to transcend some of the restrictive categories that I've been talking about here. Transcend some of those limits. And in fact, for those of you who are looking to read or reread Emerson, our guest today, James Marcus, recommends, well, why don't I save this recommendation until the end? Maybe it will come better after you've heard the discussion that I had with James. So here's what we'll do today. We'll have a listener email, then James Marcus and Ralph Waldo Emerson, and then James's recommendation. First, the email subject, a new Patreon and longtime listener email. Hello, Jack. Thank you so much for the wonderful podcast, including the thoughtful stories. I'm a recent Patreon supporter who has been listening since about fall of 2022, and I'm hoping you can help me find one of your episodes that included a poem that I hope to read a stanza or two from at my daughter's upcoming wedding. Gulp. That's the emailer who's typing that out. Gulp, not me. Although my heart did drop a bit when I read this, daughter's upcoming wedding, the old empty elevator shaft in my chest opened right up. Someone snapped the cable that holds my heart in place and down she raced. A daughter's upcoming wedding. Gulp indeed. Back to the email. I've unsuccessfully searched your long long history of podcasts for this poem slash poet, and I apologize in advance for only remembering the general theme of the episode and poem. I believe the podcast theme was family, and thought for sure it was about Thanksgiving, but could not find a Thanksgiving podcast with the poem of interest. All I remember of the poem is that the general theme was about the arc of a child's life and leaving home, using the metaphor of a bee's arc leaving the hive. Does this ring a bell at all? If not, well, no worries. I know I'm asking a lot with little guidance, so if this minimal piece of information isn't helpful, I'll start searching for another wedding-worthy piece of poetry, prose, or lyric. Regardless, many thanks for your time and, more importantly, for the wonderful podcast. Kind regards, Daniel. Okay, wow. Ugh. Gulp indeed. Helping a dad with an upcoming wedding? I just literally gulped. Oh, yikes. The pressure is on. Luckily, I knew exactly what Daniel was talking about. I did an episode on gratitude one Thanksgiving season, and I focused on four poems, I think, or five. One of them was by Sharon Olds. That's the one you're looking for, Daniel. It's called First Thanksgiving, and it is indeed beautiful. And as I looked back at the episode and thought about things a little bit, I realized now that when I put this episode out there, I had both my kids at home. And one of them was getting ready to go to college, which he has since done. He's at college now. And so I, like the poet, have been on the other side of that first Thanksgiving, or I've been on the other side of the break, the disruption that leads to the first Thanksgiving. I was worried about him leaving, and it was awful and heartrending. And him coming back for Thanksgiving was awesome and amazing, but also awful and heartrending. That's the life of a parent for you. You want to hold them so close and you don't want them to age, but since we can't stop time, you also want your kids to grow and be independent and do things and experience all those great things that you yourself maybe got to experience, or maybe some of the things that you didn't get to do. My younger son's preschool teacher said to a group of us, "Believe me, parents, all your kids are going to use the toilet eventually. You won't be changing their diapers when they're 18. That just doesn't happen." And as the stages come along, and we all laughed, of course, right? We're a little, we don't think they're ready now. Some of us maybe thought that, oh no, it's not going to work for my little Susie or my young Jimmy. He's resisting. It's not going to happen this year. And the teacher says, it will. Don't worry, it will. As it will help. As the stages come along, you dread that new stuff, but you tell yourself that the alternative is worse. I wish my boys would not go to college, but I want them to stay home and stay with me forever. But I also do want them to have that experience of college, and I'm proud of them for working towards it and for being independent and making their way in the world. Would I rather that they didn't do all that? Of course not. I don't want the 18-year-old in diapers who's got parents chasing after him saying, jump up on the table. So I'm marriage. I have not encountered that yet. I mean, not in my kids. I'm dreading that moment and a wedding and knowing that my beloved boys are one step farther away from me. But is the alternative that I sit here and hope that they never fall in love, never decide to have a lifelong companion, never find that permanence, that steadiness, that counterpart, soulmate? Of course, I don't wish that. I'm not ready for it now, but I'll be ready. To be otherwise would be kind of barbaric, or at least needier than I would ever allow myself to be. My kids have lives, and I am a mere steward. I controlled them completely when they were infants, and then gradually less so. And then I settled into a kind of dad role of advice and a helping hand and paying for things strategically to help out. But they are flying under their own power now, their young wings flapping furiously, which is the point of this poem. Here was my response to Daniel, which he has kindly allowed me to share. Hi, Daniel. I mean, he allowed me to share our whole correspondence. his emails as well. Hi, Daniel. It's very nice to hear from you, and thank you very much for the kind words and generous support. I felt a little flash of anxiety when you mentioned your daughter's wedding. I can only imagine what that must be like for you as you prepare. I'm glad to report that I can help you locate the episode in the poem. It was episode 361, Five Glimpses of Gratitude. The poem is by Sharon Olds, and it's called First Thanksgiving. Now, that was my email. I gave the poem a full rundown during the episode, and you can listen to my analysis by heading backwards in the archives to episode 361, but I'll just repeat a bit of it here. Let's read the poem. First Thanksgiving. We'll just start with the title. First Thanksgiving. Does that take you back to the pilgrims? No. Does it take you to the poet's childhood? No. This is the first Thanksgiving where your baby comes home. It's like experiencing Thanksgiving all over again for the first time. It's the first return Thanksgiving, and that it feels new, and it feels like a new reason to give thanks. Giving thanks for something brand new, which is the thanks for the life you had with this person who was in close proximity at that time, 17, 18 years. Give thanks for that and the time you now get to spend with this person and the thanks you feel even as you're in the process of letting this person go. All wrapped up with that beautiful bee metaphor. Here's the poem. It's by Sharon Olds. When she comes back from college, I will see the skin of her upper arms, cool, matte, glossy. She will hug me, my old soupy chest against her breasts. I will smell her hair. She will sleep in this apartment, her sleep like an untamed, good object, like a soul in a body. She came into my life, the second great arrival after him, fresh from the other world, which lay from within him, within me. Those nights I fed her to sleep, week after week, the moon rising and setting and waxing, whirling over the months in a slow blur around our planet. Now she doesn't need love like that. She has had it. She will walk in glowing, we will talk, and then when she's fast asleep, I'll exult to have her in that room again, behind that door. I'm going to pause there in midline because the poem shifts now. And here's the part Daniel remembered. It's the most beautiful analogy, and it works perfectly well for a wedding, I think. As a child, I caught bees by the wings and held them some seconds, looked into their wild faces, listened to them sing, then tossed them back into the air. I remember the moment the arc of my toss swerved and they entered the corrected curve of their departure. Yes, yes, that is it. As parents, we hold these little bees close to us to keep them safe, and they return to us, those wild faces and the songs they sing to us, and that's wonderful. But then eventually we toss them into the air and they move for a while with momentum that's ours. That's our arc they're following as we toss them. They follow our habits. They walk a little wobbly. They ride the bike down our street with training wheels. It's the arc of our toss with a bee. If you've ever tossed a flying creature, you've seen this. They go where we toss them, and then they correct that curve and leave on their own path, their own arc, following their own way. That's what it is with kids. They might look like us and have some of our traits, and some of those might wear off and some might stick, but they're going to fly on their own path to school or into a marriage, into a new house, a new future, a new life. They will, in other words, transcend us, which brings us to Emerson almost, because Daniel did write back and he thanked me for sending the poem. And he said he doesn't have too much anxiety about reading a poem because this is not his first wedding. At his other daughter's wedding a few years ago, he sang a song. And this wedding seems, he said, seems mild by comparison. I could see that. He also said that, quote, "The worst that can happen is that I drive folks to the dessert table. As long as my daughter is smiling, I'm good," end quote. And indeed, as long as that little bee is smiling with her wild face, Daniel is good. We are good. It's the parental code. You get the kid to smile, and we're good. Daniel also said that he looks forward to listening to more History of Literature episodes on his long walks with Oliver, his beloved red lab, which is another little postcard for me to file away on my mental bulletin board of all the kind listeners who have told me how they listen to the podcast. I'm glad Oliver the Red Lab is there with you, Daniel. And good luck to you at the wedding and to your daughter, who I'm sure will be smiling, that little bee. And I doubt she'll be alone, although she might be the only bee that matters in that moment. One more thing to recommend Ralph Waldo Emerson, the title of James Marcus's book, Glad to the Brink of Fear. What a phrase that is. All that stuff I told you at the beginning about how different America was, well, that's relevant. We'll talk about that with James, but I'll kind of give it away. Glad to the Brink of Fear. That sounds universal to me. That sounds timeless. That sounds like something I feel often. I was going to say always. Only when I'm not glad, I guess, am I not glad to the brink of fear. Getting glad to the brink of fear, is that something I should feel as ambivalent about as I do? Is that something to embrace? Is that something I should be scared of? Does it make me weird? Well, let's hear what James Marcus has to say. James Marcus, after this. Hey, grown-ups, the Cat in the Hat cast is a new podcast from Wondery, perfect for the whole family. Join the Cat in the Hat and your favorite Dr. Seuss characters as they get whisked away on a new adventure every week. Fish dreams of creating his very own polite and quiet podcast. That is, until he gets a surprise visit to his Fishbowl podcast studio from the Cat in the Hat himself, and it becomes very clear that the cat has other plans for the podcast, and those plans are the opposite of quiet. The cat may be disruptive, but it turns out he's also a great help to get Fish out of all kinds of predicaments. Bursting with music, silliness, and rhymes, the Cat in the Hat cast encourages us all to find fun that is funny in every episode. Sing along to new favorite songs, try your luck at Titanic tongue twisters, have some fun with wondrous wordplay, and most importantly, bring your family along for all of the adventures in the Cat in the Hat cast. Follow the Cat in the Hat cast on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to the Cat in the Hat cast ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Wondery Kids Plus in Apple Podcasts. Okay, joining me now is James Marcus, an editor, translator, and critic who is the author of Amazonia, 5 years at the epicenter of the dot-com juggernaut. He's also written and lectured widely on Ralph Waldo Emerson, and he's here today to discuss his new book, Glad to the Brink of Fear, a portrait of Ralph Waldo Emerson. James Marcus, welcome to the History of Literature.
Oh, thanks. I'm delighted to be here.
So I thought I'd start with a memory I have. You and I actually did overlap at Amazon a bit, and I remember something you said to me once. People maybe might forget now, or younger listeners might not even really know that Amazon started as kind of the greatest bookstore in the world, and then by the time I got there, they were launching music and video and kitchen and tools and electronics, all these other stores. And once I said to you, "Hi, James, how are things going?" And you said, "Every day I go to a meeting and find a little more of my job has been replaced by an algorithm." which people today can probably identify with even more. So, but before we get to Amazon, let's go back a little bit further to when your interest in literature began. What was your career before you went to Amazon?
My career prior to Amazon was that of a freelance writer. I was interested in writing fiction. I'd gotten an MFA from Columbia in 1985, I think. But I was doing all sorts of other literary chores. I was writing book reviews. I began to write about music. I had begun a career as a translator from the Italian. And then I did the million freelance tasks that every freelance writer is obliged to do as you bundle together all the worst paying labor in the world. So I was a freelancer before I went to Amazon.
And were you living in New York?
I'm from New York and have spent most of my life there, but I was actually living in Portland, Oregon. I was married. We had a little 3-year-old, and we very much wanted a break from the challenges of being a poor young couple in New York City. So we moved to Portland, where my wife's family was. And I liked Portland a whole lot, but then this call came from Amazon, which was itself an obscure company that no one had ever heard of. And I actually needed a job right at that moment.
Right.
So we decided to, you know, roll the dice and move up to Seattle, which was not so far away, and give Amazon a shot.
Right. And what did they want you to do at Amazon?
Well, you know, in theory, I was hired as an editor and writer, but those were very fluid categories at Amazon. I think it's really hard to convey to people now how in 1996, online commerce was hardly even in its infancy. It hardly even existed.
Right.
No one knew what it would be like. And when it came to the idea of an online bookstore, no one knew what that would be like, or whether it would include some kind of forums or a way to communicate with customers directly, whether there would be a magazine-like component. So you were roped into Amazon, you know, under the rubric of writer-editor, but the idea was that there was going to be a lot of making it up as you went along. That they were very loosely defined job category.
Yeah. Did you think it could contribute to literature?
Oh, sure. When I started, you know, it was just the bookstore. Nothing else was sold there. And there was a very utopian feeling about it. The idea that people who lived, you know, 150 miles from a good bookstore could now order just about any book 24 hours a day and have it delivered. It was very exciting for a book-loving person like myself.
Right.
And another thing it is very hard to convey now is that certainly for the first year or two, that authors and publishers greeted Amazon with a lot of excitement. Mm. You know, I mean, Amazon has become sort of the great Satan in some ways now, but authors and publishers alike loved the idea that their books could be delivered to anybody, any time.
Right.
And publishers in particular, initially, it seemed like this new conduit of business was not cannibalizing their old sales. And in retrospect, it's very clear that that would not last forever.
Yeah.
But at first, it just seemed like a gift from God. Like, oh my God, there's a percentage of book sales that are being added on to regular sales. No one was going to look that gift horse in the mouth. Everybody was ecstatic about it.
Yeah. And books that, like a back catalog for an author, might be more available than it would have been just on a bookstore shelf. It's a finite space in the bookstore.
Of course. And Amazon, in theory, offered infinite shelf space. And they offered books you could never, ever find in a bookstore.
Yeah.
So that was exciting. That made me feel good about myself. And it made up for feeling less good about myself later on.
Right. I can remember when I was there, the most famous of authors would just be walking through the halls. I think they were excited to be in the building and seeing what was going on inside and talking to the editors. And it was really a fun and vibrant place. But already the shadows were starting to grow. I was only there for 3 years, but it changed from the time I was there to the time I left.
Yeah, well, that was a company with the capacity for very rapid change. And, you know, they still have it in a way, but now it's, you know, just a giant leviathan. It's harder to turn the vessel around. But yeah, that place was transforming right in front of your eyes. And I, too, remember all of these authors coming through the joint which in a way was very mundane looking. You know, I don't know if they mm-hmm. expected sort of like the Wizard of Oz's showroom, but right. it's just a bunch of people in cubicles. I will say that only one author who came through ever said to me, "Can I see the machine room?" In other words, where all the servers were.
Yeah.
And that was Richard Powers. He wanted to see the techno beating heart of the business, but of course he was not permitted to look in the machine room.
I can remember an author who said to me, I said, well, good luck with your book. And he said, yeah, I hope it makes us both a lot of money. And that was Michael Lewis.
Well, he seems to have done very nicely.
Yeah.
So
it did make him
no
a lot of money,
there.
I'm pretty sure.
Yeah. Right, of course.
Okay. So what did you do after you left Amazon? How did you decompress from that pressure cooker?
Yeah, well, you know, I left Amazon after 5 years. That was not a mysterious number. It was, you know, many of the early employees were on a 5-year vest.
Right, right.
Meaning that you got your options 20% per year, and at the end of 5 years, you got them all. And so even if you were having a less of a good time there, which I think would describe me, probably after the first 3 years, it began to be less fun. And there was that feeling of your job perpetually being nibbled away by technology. I was ready to go at 5 years, but I hung on that long. And you know, as I say in my book, Amazonia, I had already found in the printer a memo about staffing, which noted that I would probably soon be gone due to what was called natural attrition. Sounds like a very bad disease to have. But they were correct, because my 5th anniversary was approaching and I clearly was less excited. I came back to New York, where I'm from, but for several reasons. My family and friends were in New York. The publishing business was in New York, and I thought I would be involved in that in some way. I had also fallen in love with someone in New York, and either I was going there or she was coming to Seattle. And in the end, I went back to New York. I spent some time working on writing projects. I translated a couple of books. I wrote a novel that I could not publish. And then at a certain point, I really thought, you know what? I should write a book about Amazon. Mm-hmm. That was not my intention while I was working there. I was not busily taking notes all the time. But when I left there and my brain pan cooled down a little bit, I just started thinking that was too interesting an experience to not try to put it down on paper. And that the longer I waited, the more I would forget it all. So probably within 6 months of arriving back in New York, I decided to write a book. And I wrote this book called Amazonia, and it was published by the New Press. And I thought I got down at least some sense of the atmosphere there.
Yeah.
You know, like most books, mine was myopic, and mine was myopic because I really knew my own little piece of the business, which was working as an editor in the books division. I wasn't, you know, connected to bigger business decisions, and God forbid, I was not connected to technological decisions. So my only idea was to render with some truth what it was like to be in my kind of job there as a humanist who had wandered into the dark wood of the internet. And I was happy with the book in that way. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I've kept an eye on Amazon in the succeeding years. I mean, my time there is like a generation ago now. So, you know, I don't pretend to any great expertise about Amazon now as a company, except in the limited sense that I think some of the DNA was already present.
Right.
In terms of what the company would turn into. So you can see a lot of the seeds of what would happen later. But obviously now I'm just a consumer,
yeah,
and someone with an unusual interest in the company, but I don't follow it closely anymore.
Yeah. Well, it was nice that you recorded it, because I can remember thinking, even when I was there, a lot of people were writing about Amazon, and I remember thinking, this really is not what I'm experiencing right now. And your book is different because you were actually on the inside. And it was kind of the first time I realized, you know, sometimes the more you know about something, the less the journalism about it seems accurate or seems mm-hmm. to really capture something. It really is kind of different when people are trying to see something from the outside.
Yeah, I think that's true. And really, I was trying to convey the texture of life in that extremely weird environment. Obviously, I did research to supply context for my experience, because I didn't have a diary. And also, I didn't remember when the initial public offering was and when we expanded into, you know, power tools and so forth. Mm-hmm. So I had to erect a little bit of an infrastructure around my own memories. But I mean, I also learned some lessons from writing that book, because I had never written an extended work of nonfiction in which I used the real names and identities of other people. And it was a good lesson in some ways of how delicate that operation can be, mm-hmm. and how easy it is to kind of trample on someone else's experience, mm-hmm. Even when you think all of your intentions are good. I mean, I didn't have an axe grinding attitude toward Amazon, but nonetheless, I realized there were a couple of people who I hurt or outraged with my, to them, rough handling of their experience. So it was a lesson to me as well.
Mm. Okay, well, let's turn to Emerson. And I'm wondering, when you first started reading Emerson, and Emerson seems like the kind of author that you could read at different ages and take away totally different experiences. So I'm wondering, what did you read first, and how old were you, and what were your earliest impressions?
I was spared the initial Emerson experience that people probably just a generation before me had, which is that Emerson used to be part of the school curriculum. You would read part of Self-Reliance or something like that. And I don't think Emerson is really a writer for school children.
Yeah.
And I think that inculcated a certain amount of resentment.
Yeah. Who's this old fogey with this clotted prose? Yeah,
exactly. And I think that's unfortunate, because, you know, he is not a writer designed for school children. Mm-hmm. I was probably just the first generation that was Emerson free in the curriculum. Yeah. So I didn't really encounter him till later in my life. And actually, it was while I was at Amazon, probably, you know, 3 years or so into my time there. And I was having an extraordinarily difficult moment. My job was very demanding there. I was married then, and my wife was dealing with some chronic illness, and I had a young child who was experiencing the ripple effects of what happens when your parents are having a hard time. And so I felt very lonely and isolated dealing with all these problems. And in our household was an old Penguin Classics edition of Emerson's Essays, which had traveled with us to various domiciles, but I had never read it very much. And I found myself often in the wee hours of the night while my child and my wife were sleeping, drawn to those essays. Mm. And it's mysterious in a way, because Emerson's essays are not personal,
mm-hmm.
not in our current sense of the word. And he doesn't wear his own tribulations and his difficulties and his bereavements, of which there were many, on his sleeve. There are very few instances where he talks about his personal struggles. So he seems like a strange person to turn to be consoled. But there was something in those essays that really appealed to me and comforted me. And I think part of it was that there is an ecstatic note in Emerson's work, which is very appealing and beautiful. And I think I also sensed there was a desire to be truthful. Mm. I think there's a strong truth-seeking impulse in Emerson, which can be a little bit concealed by the elaborateness of his prose, but he is always trying to tell the truth. And somehow those two things really appealed to me and really comforted me in some strange way. And so I then turned from reading the essays to reading about this person. That meant reading his letters and reading his journals, which by themselves are like a monumental work of literature, and delving into the biographical literature about him. And the more I learned about him, the more inspiring I found him. And I think really commenced what will probably be a lifelong dalliance, yeah. or perhaps deep romance with this person, who's not always easy to read and who's not always easy to understand, but a brilliant and inspiring and ultimately very lovable human being. And so that got things started, and I just continued. I didn't immediately think I would write a book about Emerson, but I really did feel that here was a kind of companionship that I thought would last for a long time.
Yeah.
And it offered some of the exhilarating feeling when you meet a person who you think, oh my gosh, I'm going to be friends with this person. You know, we're going to mean a lot to each other. I had a similar sensation as I got into my Emersonian groove.
And what, getting back to when you were first drawn to him, when you were going through those struggles yourself, and you describe him as a truth teller, but also someone who is still conveying a kind of exuberance. Is it fair to to characterize his writings as someone who's dealing with reality and knows that it's harsh and knows that there are problems and knows that life is full of a lot of pain. And he doesn't shy away from that, but he still is able to present a kind of exuberance or forward-looking optimism without it seeming like happy talk that kind of covers up or brushes under the rug some of the harshnesses of life.
You know, I think that's a very excellent description, the one you just delivered. I think Emerson is sometimes pilloried as a happy talk man, you know, as a positive thinking man. And that was certainly his reputation. You know, he's the guy who said, hitch your wagon to a star. He's the guy who said, trust thyself. And those things are all true. And that is a very important part of who he is as a writer and a human being. He's someone very open to exhilaration and ecstasy. But I don't think he was immune to pain. And I don't think that was excluded from his work. And I think when you look at an essay like Experience, which was written in the immediate aftermath of the death of his 5-year-old son, Waldo Emerson, who died of scarlet fever in 1842, Experience is one of Emerson's greatest essays. And I think those polarities are brought so close together in a piece of writing like that, just the enormous pain and grief that is part of being alive, but the ecstatic joy of being alive. Those currents are always present in Emerson. They're not always there at the same time. He may lean more heavily on one or the other, but he always knew they were both there. And I also think, and this is not a big surprise, that the younger Emerson who wrote Self-Reliance and the older Emerson who wrote the essays collected in a book like The Conduct of Life, I mean, his view of life darkened as he grew older because he experienced the pain and disappointment that is part of life. He was perhaps less exhilarated as a 50-year-old than he was as a 25-year-old, but I think that's often the way it goes. You know, life has its way with you, and you realize that everything is not ecstasy and joy, but that there's a struggle to it. But all of those things are there in his greatest work, and he articulates them all beautifully. He is certainly not the kind of smiling, ecstatic, who never recognized the pain and evil in the world. That's definitely a cartoon of Emerson, but not the real thing.
Okay, let's take a quick break and then return with more from James Marcus. So, James, I wanted to ask you, your book is described as an engaging reassessment of the celebrated essayist and his relevance to contemporary readers. And I was going to ask why a reassessment was needed and what the misconception is in the general audience today. But maybe we've already touched on it. Is it that people perceive him as being either an old fogey not worth reading or being a kind of happy talk warrior? Or what's being reassessed here?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think Emerson, who was born in 1803 and died in 1882, has been around as a pillar of American intellectual life long enough to go through several wash cycles, you know, of reassessment. But I do think, you know, by the 1870s and the 1880s, around the time he died in 82, he got buried under the debris of his Victorian reputation. That would be my diagnosis, that the kind of smiling apostle of good feelings was what people thought he was, and that's what allowed him to survive into the 20th century and become part of the middle school curriculum, that he just seemed like he was an apostle of uplift and positive thinking. And there's also the sense that he was absorbed into business culture. In other words, self-reliance and self-actualization were sort of absorbed in the Gilded Age into a kind of Darwinian view of business culture. And so his life as a cultural force was extended in that way as well. he seemed to give the blessing to a Darwinian view of business culture where it's every man for himself, and you stomped out whatever you needed to actualize yourself in the form of money. And so those two images of Emerson survived into the 20th century, but I think they're both completely inadequate to the complicated and beautiful figure that he is.
Right.
So I wanted to, and there have been some great reassessments and great biographies of Emerson written in the late 20th century. Robert D. Richardson's The Mind on Fire is a masterpiece. Gay Wilson Allen's somewhat earlier Waldo Emerson, which I think is from the 1980s, those are both wonderful books. And they began to kick away some of that debris and present Emerson as a fresh and very much alive human being. But here we are in the 2020s, as improbable as that seems. And I just think Emerson is such an incredibly relevant figure, and that he can speak to us so directly. And that's really what I wanted to convey, that here's a figure who doesn't require the sort of corrective glasses that you wear as a scholar or a fan of 19th century literature, or even a fan of sort of Americana, that his greatest work speaks to us very directly, as if it was written the day before yesterday, and as if it's being addressed a few inches from your ear. And that was what hooked me myself. And I wanted to convey that electrical feeling of very direct contact with someone who died a very long time ago, but whose voice is resonant and alive.
Right. So I've got a sentence here that I noted in your book where you say, so many of the conundrums of modern American life, identity, race, inequality, ecological apocalypse, and the endless tug of war between the individual and the tribe were anticipated by this slope-shouldered prophet in his rocking chair. And I wanted to read that just to give people a taste of the fine prose of James Marcus.
But, thank you.
But also, we've got sort of a plethora of things on the table there for ways that he, that you're arguing, he does speak to us today. So do you want to take up one of those and tell us kind of where he was and why it's so relevant to a contemporary audience?
Sure. I mean, let's start with identity, mm-hmm. which is an obsession of our cultural moment. Emerson was also obsessed with the idea of identity his entire life, the idea of who you are. And in some ways, incessant preaching of the gospel of individualism was a way to say that you need to be investigating who you are all the time. And that the easy route to all of this was to simply accept the kind of tribal or group or ethnic identity that had been handed to you. And he thought that was a very pernicious thing, that it wasn't only lazy, but that you were selling yourself short as a human being. So his idea, his great line was that every human being should have an original relation to the universe. In other words, that every human being should look at themselves and look at the world and the universe and the community and figure it out for yourself, figure out who you are for yourself. And I think that's terribly bracing right at this moment, which is not to say that identity, group identity, ethnic identity, those things are not meaningless. They're very meaningful. But I think Emerson would say that should not be the sum total of who you are. Your identity card that is issued to you by whatever circumstances you were born into is important, but it should not be defining, and that you should rely on your gut and your instinct and your own perception of the world to figure out who you are. I think that's really important, like right now.
Yeah.
Now, there are ways in which the gospel of individualism can be destructive, and people criticize Emerson for those reasons, because it has a tendency to torpedo community, and it loosens the bonds between you and the other people around you. And yes, that is an American problem. It has been an American problem since de Tocqueville visited here. He observed Americans and said, they're crazy for a kind of individualism, and that ultimately that means each person will be confined in the prison of the human heart. And that's very eloquent, and he's correct. I think an aspect of Emerson that people overlook, however, is that he recognized that we were also connected to each other. He had this whole idea of what he called the oversoul, which was a kind of, let's say, spiritual equivalent of the cloud, into which all human beings could connect, and that you were an individual who was simultaneously connected to every other human being. And he also recognized that in certain calamitous civic moments, that the only cure was communal, that you couldn't solve everything as an individual. So I think the package that he's preaching there is a great one for this moment, because we are also aware of, we're aware of and sometimes confined by our sense of identity. And we also are constantly worrying about our connection to the crowd, which is comforting and important for human beings, but we can be swallowed up and de-individualized by it. So I think what he has to say is utterly urgent and contemporary. And, you know, it's not the same thing, by the way, as saying that Emerson is a man of 2024. I'm not trying to put Emerson in sweatpants and a quarter zip sleeve top. You know, that's not who he is. He comes from another era. But yeah. I do think some of that stuff is expressed with incredible urgency and beauty, and it's completely valid at this moment.
Right. It renders the question that I was going to ask kind of moot, because I was going to say, what if a critic today would say, well, why should we listen to a guy who was trying to define who we were, but from the viewpoint of a white 19th century New Englander male, when what we really have in America today is, you know, we have people living in Texas and Alaska and men and women, and we, you know, all kinds of different races, Asian Americans, African Americans, like it's a whole different kind of project to try to define an American today than it might have seemed to Emerson at the time. But it, when you describe it as him having, wanting to have each individual develop their own relation to the universe and kind of get beyond some of the tribal categories or some of the inherited, you know, ways of looking at oneself. But I guess it kind of begs the question, where does the community then come from? Is there something American about this project, or did he come up with any principles that Americans would tend to share or anything like that that could translate to a way to stitch together this crazy country that we live in?
Yeah, well, you know, Emerson thrived on contradiction. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's a very baseline idea about him. And I think that for him, individualism and communitarianism were like flip sides of the same coin. And it's actually fascinatingly true of de Tocqueville as well, who during his voyage to America noted this kind of crazy tropism toward individuality, but also noted that Americans love to organize themselves into groups and organizations.
Yeah.
And, you know, when I first encountered that, I was like, wait a minute, you just said, but then I realized, no, it's the same thing, because these tendencies are symbiotic. The more individual and atomized you are, the more you want some kind of community. And the more you feel yourself swallowed up by community, the more you want to break away and be an individual. Yeah. And I think that particular dynamic is very American. Yeah. You know, it's very embedded in American history. And so I do think, as you were just saying, that part of Emerson's view of human beings is to pay attention to the particularity of every single human being. You know, Emerson wrote a book called Representative Men, which was kind of his personal pantheon. And you have, you know, Goethe in there, and you have Napoleon, and people who he thought exemplified important parts of, like, the human experience. And sometimes people will say, well, look, he's just an exponent of the great man theory. Hmm. But the trick there is that Emerson thought that every man could be a great man and that every woman could be a great woman. So there wasn't any sort of aristocracy or inherited greatness. Mm-hmm. It was that every human being could be great. He recognized that every human being wasn't great, but that he felt the potential was there. And there's a beautiful democratic impulse there, I think. So, of course, it's not always easy to see every human being as the particular human being and also as part of a bigger group or tribe or whatever. But I think there's a strong Emersonian imperative to try to do that, to look microscopically and macroscopically at people and events at the same time.
Is there a sort of delusion in this? The analogy that came to mind was, you know, the idea that we're listening to rock and roll because we're rebels and we want to rebel, but it turns out that that's all, you know, we're all listening to the same thing and wearing the same clothes when we go to the concerts together in this big, is it misleading to think, well, we're a nation full of individuals, you know, but then actually that's how we define ourselves as a nation?
Right. There is a pulsating contradiction there. I would agree with you that, yeah, we're all alike. We're all individuals. I mean, there's an absurdity and a joke to it.
Right.
But I think, I mean, look, Emerson came from an intensely tribal group. He was a Boston Brahmin, you know, and he rebelled against it. And he was still it. I mean, I think he was aware of the very rich and sometimes comic contradictions that come from that. And the other thing I would say, and this I think is related to what you're talking about, is that another of the million contradictions of Emersonian thought is, yes, he wants you to have absolute faith in your own perceptions and understandings of the world, but he wants you to constantly be reexamining those perceptions and understandings. In other words, it's trust yourself, but don't trust yourself too much. Because he felt that the minute you stopped examining your assumptions, you sort of died as a psychological sentient human being, that you calcified into a bundle of your opinions, and that you just ceased to be alive anymore in a way. So I guess he would say, like, yeah, you're at the rock and roll concert, like every other person who thinks they're a rebel, but you should constantly be reexamining your own status as a rebel and deciding what's valid about it. And at a certain point, being really conventional is rebellion. And so you have to keep alive your understanding of the world. And I think that that means questioning your need to question everything. Now, it could be recursive and crazy at a certain point. And he's not saying you should just sit there sort of picking at scabs for the rest of your life, but he does feel like you've got to keep subjecting your own opinions to the kind of bright light of your own sentience and curiosity. And so I guess there's an idea that you're erecting a little bit of a firewall against just settling down into complacency.
Right. Now, one of the things that always strikes me when I read the 19th century American thinkers is they really, they're asking this question of, well, who are we and what exactly is going on here? And the big thing is, you know, are we European? Are we old world? Are we new world? How do we look to the West? What is Europe? What kind of grip does Europe have on us exactly? And now that we're a couple of hundred years later, I'm wondering if you think that's still a kind of relevant issue for us, or is it something that we've moved beyond? What is the status of how America situates itself in its own mind?
Yeah. Well, I mean, look, Emerson was born in 1803, so he's basically the first post-revolutionary generation, which is very kind of hard to think about. But
yeah,
because
right.
He lived way into the Gilded Age, and he lived into sort of early modernity. But, you know, the American Revolution was 20-odd years before he was born, and he was still in that cultural penumbra, I think. And he was of the generation to say, what does it mean to be an American now? And how are we different? And a lot of his cultural mission was, in fact, to define a new sort of Americanness and a new sort of person and figure out how that was distinctive from the old world. So he was a post-colonial who was really just asking the riddle over and over. How do you define what it means to be an American? I think that 200 years later, that question is less urgent. I think, for better or worse, we've had a long time to settle into our Americanness in the ways that are beautiful and in the ways that are difficult and horrifying at times. Emerson recognized that there was a kind of intensity and speed and hysteria to Americanness that made it different from the old world and different from England. And I think he recognized what was inspiring and what was destructive about it. There's a great passage where he just said, you know, we can't slow down, our steamships explode. You know, there were things like that he thought were emblematic of an American urgency that was both inspiring and a little bit frightening. He also noted how American towns spring up overnight. You know, someone wants to have a college and they simply build one. There wasn't the slow motion unfolding that he thought was typical of European culture. And I think the things he recognized about the American character are still there. They may be exaggerated, but they're still there. And I think we're less tormented as a nation now by what it means to be an American. Maybe being less tormented is bad. Maybe that's a kind of complacency as well. But I think he recognized traits that are still there. and he recognized them very early on and was very, very curious about the question of what it meant to be an American and also what it meant to be an American writer, how you were different, how your perceptions and means and methods were different.
Do you see that as an area where he's also kind of putting his finger on a current pulse?
Yeah, I think the things he observed about the sort of accelerated feeling of American life, mm-hmm. those things are still true. And it's interesting to me as well that when you have a person like Henry James, the novelist, who was someone Emerson had known since Henry James was a boy, because Emerson was friendly with Henry James Sr., the Swedenborgian dad of the James family. Henry James viewed America's cultural impoverishment as a real problem. Henry James was drawn to European culture, and he moved to England and stayed there for the rest of his life, because in contrast to what he saw as the richness and antiquity of European culture, that America was empty. You know, there was nothing there. It was like a giant log cabin. And it's interesting to me that Emerson, who's a generation earlier, did not have that feeling at all, that for him, the emptiness of America was exhilarating, and it offered a potential that far outstripped anything you were going to find in England. And, you know, Emerson wrote a book called English Traits, which is a kind of a travelogue about England, but also an attempt to diagnose the character, to figure out what Englishness was at its deepest level. And in a way, it's a weird inverse portrait of America, because, I mean, England was then at its height as an industrial power and world power and imperial power. And Emerson couldn't help but note those things, but everything that America didn't have, all the things that were not English about America, he found very exciting. And he already predicted when that book came out in 1856 that England might be reaching its zenith, and that if it did, it would be America who would sort of pick up the torch in terms of industrial and world power. And that turned out to be true. You might say that that's a jingoistic prediction, but I think for Emerson, it was weirdly kind of a metaphysical one too, that he felt that the richness and greatness of English culture was going to start to fade, and that America was on the rise. I mean, there's an element of manifest destiny there, but also just a fascination with the possibilities of the continent.
Now, one way to look at that might be just kind of the physical and the geography of it, and to say, you can imagine Henry James saying, well, look at Europe. It has the museums, it has the history, it has the buildings, it has the population density and all of this. And then an Emerson type saying, well, America's got Niagara Falls and it's got the frontier and it's got these great mm-hmm. unexplored woods and that kind of thing. But it almost seems like with Emerson, he was also talking about just the psychic clearing away of established patterns and social structures and everything that would be kind of a weight. And there was kind of an excitement in being able to face the world anew and having the room that you needed to define yourself and to have that kind of relationship with the universe, that maybe he found Europe to be kind of oppressive in that sense, that it was imposing on you a lot of rigid forms of identity.
Oh, that's absolutely true. Yes, absolutely. It's not simply a matter of, oh gosh, we don't have enough cathedrals and museums. He wasn't bothered by that. And I think you're absolutely right that there's the physical vastness of America, which was very exciting, but also America as a space for psychic renovation, that every person could make themselves up from scratch. I mean, Emerson loved England, but he also felt that this was a place where social roles had been locked in for centuries and where there was very little wiggle room to reinvent yourself. And contrarily in America, that was the whole point of it, you know, that everybody started from square one in America. Now, I mean, Emerson was the product of seven generations in America. So for the time, he was not a newbie anymore.
Right.
But even so, the idea that you could make yourself up from scratch was immensely appealing and exciting. And there seemed much less opportunity for that in Europe.
And to feel from his vantage point, even though he maybe didn't experience it himself in this way, but to know just the flood of immigrants that were coming in, the waves of immigrants coming in the 19th century, and to know that everybody who was, you know, getting off that boat and walking onto the shore was in that position to be able to reinvent themselves and to make of themselves something new and something that was, you know, coming in with kind of a blank slate. He must have felt the energy that would give to a continent.
Yeah, I think he felt the enormous energies there. Now, I mean, early in his life, the United States was a less diverse country. But still, you know, later in his life, he started to have the mass migration of the Irish. He started to have Germans and other Central Europeans coming to America. And he saw how that was transforming the place. Now, Emerson, at some points in his life, expressed some hearty enthusiasm for Anglo-Saxon leadership. And he has been, you know, rightly criticized for that. But he also made some very beautiful statements, not using the actual terminology of the melting pot, but saying that America drew its great energies from what he called crossings, you know, the interbreeding and melting together of many different races. So he sometimes expressed that idea very directly and very beautifully.
The one thing I haven't asked you about is the title, Glad to the Brink of Fear. And when we started out this conversation, we kind of talked about Emerson being somebody who was aware of the pain of life, but then was willing to recognize that and absorb it and not shrink away from it, but also to still face life with some exuberance. But Glad to the Brink of Fear almost makes it sound like the happiness can take you to a darker place. It can come full circle. So where does that phrase come from, and why is it on the cover of your book?
That phrase comes from Nature, his first book and his first sort of important published writing. And really, it refers to an ecstatic state. Mm. And what he is saying is that there are moments of joy and connection that are so intense that they are almost frightening. That they're almost too much to be handled. I don't think in that particular case he's saying that he's not really saying it's dark and frightening, but he's saying it's almost too much to bear. And I think that is one of the most beautiful perceptions or states of being that he writes about and returns to. There is a strong ecstatic thread in his work, and he did feel that there were these moments when you were open to the entire universe, you know, and that things flooded into you, whether they were emotions or a kind of intelligence or a kind of raw feeling that you normally did not have access to. And that those are the greatest moments in life. And again, he didn't have time to this feeling. If you were, you would burn out like the filament in a light bulb. You couldn't handle it. But he did feel that if you were open and alert to the world around you, that you would be lucky enough to have that door open and to be flooded with that kind of feeling and perception, and that was the greatest thing in life in a way. And so that seemed important enough to me to make it the title of the book. And it's a sensation that I hanker after. You know, you can't flip it on and off like a light switch. But I feel like there are times in my life where I feel like I seem to know more and feel more than I usually can. And they're important moments and important sensations to me. So it seemed worth memorializing them in the book title.
Do you ever get to those moments when you're reading?
Yeah, sometimes, absolutely. Yeah. Like there's a sense of intense connection with something that you almost feel like you wrote it yourself. You know, there's a strange sense of exchanging identities with the writer. And of course, those are amazing moments. Now, there's many other kinds of pleasures to be derived from reading. You know, you're not like that all the time.
Yeah.
You're being entertained. You're laughing. You're recognizing something that seems familiar to you. But there are moments of electricity flowing between reader and writer that are remarkable. And you know it when it's happening. And I would, by the way, add to that, you know, we haven't been discussing it, but Emerson had a decades-long career as a lecturer on what was called the Lyceum Circuit. So he just went back and forth, peddling his wares, delivering new lectures and essays all over the country and in the, you know, the sort of often frozen interior of the U.S. And Emerson felt that the lecture was a whole new form of literature, a whole new way of connecting with people. And for him, when that connection was open, it was two-way. You know, that the lecturer and the audience were simultaneously transformed. And so that's very much like the connection between reader and writer that we're talking about. And it was very important to him.
Right. And maybe one can hope the connection between a podcast and a podcast listener, especially if they're helped along by a guest like James Marcus. The book is called Glad to the Brink of Fear, A Portrait of Ralph Waldo Emerson. James Marcus, thank you so much for joining me on the History of Literature.
Thanks for having me. It's been a great pleasure.
Okay, there we go. That's going to do it for this episode of The History of Literature. My thanks to James Marcus for joining me. Do check out his book at a bookstore near you. James told me after our interview that for anyone looking to read or reread Emerson, he recommends starting with The Transcendentalist, that essay, which is unusually pellucid for Emerson. That's James's phrase. Other works might be greater or more important, but as James puts it, in The Transcendentalist, you see Emerson trying to explain things in a way that might make the most sense to those new to Emerson's ideas and way of writing. Thank you, James, for that tip. And my thanks to you, dear listeners. And to Daniel, our new Patreon, you can head over to patreon.com/literature if you'd like to join Daniel and the rest of our angelic patrons who have signed up there. Or you can donate on a one-time basis. I almost said none-time basis. Yes, if you want to sign up on a none-time basis, well, I guess this is the only place not to go. You can go anywhere you want to sign up on a none-time. Don't even go on the internet. Just open your door and shout out, I'm not donating to the History of Literature podcast with Jack Wilson. And wait for the applause from your neighbors who will be thrilled to know that you have probably joined them in doing that or not doing that, statistically speaking. But if you're interested in donating on a one-time basis, you can do so without disturbing your neighbors at historyofliterature.com/donate. Oh boy. We have some excellent episodes on the horizon, so do sign up or follow or subscribe so you don't miss those, like our look at Necromantics, which is coming up soon, and Mad Women, also coming up soon, and Ernest Hemingway, one of his great short stories and a classic Japanese work from the 19th century. And John Buchan, author of The 39 Steps. We'll talk to his biographer, who also happens to be a member of his family. And Upton Sinclair, author of The Jungle. We'll talk with a novelist about why she kind of misses the days of Upton Sinclair and how she's tried to import some of that spirit into her novel. And many other great slices of literature besides. What was Hitchcock's line? Some directors make films that are slices of life. Mine are slices of cake. Well, let's hope we can say the same. Slices of cake for you, the listener. I'm Jack Wilson. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time